officially recording now.
Okay.
So, this is another episode of Better, Worse, or the Same. And today on the show, we brought back Dr. Erin Blake. She was on some of our earlier shows. So, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
It's funny, I say show as if this is like an ongoing thing, but quite honestly, it kind of died. It went into lockdown with COVID, and it's slowly coming back.
It's but like a phoenix.
It's like a phoenix. Absolutely. But part of the reason I wanted to bring you back on the show is that prior to one of the last episodes I did, which was on knights and archers in the 1300s, mm-hmm. our interview about medical decision making was the most popular. So congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm glad to contribute.
I know. All right. So part of the reason I wanted to bring you back on the show and talk to you is that I really like your background that is not so clinical. I mean, it's very clinical. You have a lot of medical experience and a lot of medical knowledge and education, but you didn't take the real traditional path to go through med school.
And I took a very circuitous route.
Yes. And I like the way that you talk about things and I like the way you think about things. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about, and the last time we talked, it was COVID was ramping up. And you saw this in COVID a little bit where this idea, where ideas would take hold and then the medical establishment, for better or worse, would hang on to certain ideas despite evidence to the contrary. So, for example, ventilators took a long time for us to say, maybe we shouldn't be doing this. Masks were employed much longer than they needed to be.
In my world.
Are you serious? You guys are still doing masks?
Yes, there's a very vigorous discussion about it in my context. We're still wearing masks.
Wow.
Yeah.
Goodness. Okay. So you would be a perfect person to talk to. I don't really necessarily want to delve into COVID so much, but I want to talk about your experiences where medical ideas or scientific ideas, if you want to branch into that, held on much longer despite evidence to the contrary.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're seeing that all the time. I'm a gynecologic oncologist. So we do chemotherapy and surgery as well. So in the history of cancer, there are multiple examples of continuing to do things that probably are no longer as evidence proven as we like to think that they are. And I think, you know, surgically probably the best example of that is radical surgery. And that kind of started with radical mastectomies.
Sure.
And, you know, has been brought down to trying to do lumpectomies or trying to do neoadjuvant chemo or radiation first and sparing at least the nerves and muscles on the chest.
So before you delve into it too much, I'm sorry to cut you off, but
no.
You're talking radical mastectomies where everything comes out. You're talking lumpectomies where we do partial surgeries of the cancerous regions. But the old way was cut everything off, cut everything out.
Yep, to the ribs.
Okay. Perfect. And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there, but you were about different chemotherapies and different things there.
Yes, and I think right now we're kind of in the midst of a similar situation in that we have both the traditional chemotherapies and those are called cytotoxic chemotherapies, and those are the ones that, you know, came from mustard gas or come from the yew tree and are fairly toxic. Mm-hmm. And the comparison is more targeted therapies, and there are many different brands of targeted therapies. You know, there are different types, and this all has come about with molecular profiling of tumor types, and we're seeing lots of different responses. But unfortunately, the guidelines haven't caught up with some of the newer newer therapeutics. And so, like, for most of the cancers I treat, with recent exceptions to this, we still start with traditional chemotherapy. And we know that those chemotherapies suppress the immune system. And then our next line is an immunotherapy, which boosts the immune system. So, you know, it seems like we're probably doing something that is a little bit counterintuitive when you really look at it, but we still follow guidelines, and we're very strapped by insurance to follow these guidelines that haven't necessarily been updated. And it's very hard to overturn guidelines. It's very hard to get beyond the paradigm of traditional cytotoxic chemotherapy, and potentially, you know, save that for later or abandon that altogether. But we're kind of in the midst of a transition right now. And I think that, you know, in terms of studies, we're doing a very good job of trying to mobilize that transition. Mm-hmm. But there's certainly people that don't follow or adhere to current more evidence-based guidelines. And so that's always a problem within the field. And then, you know, just trying to get NCCN and FDA approvals to match the rate at which we're making these discoveries that affect outcomes is almost an impossible task. So that's kind of the context we're operating within right now.
You're talking a little bit about guidelines. You talked a little bit about insurance. Briefly, if you could kind of explore a little bit, why do you think that we have this cognitive inertia with doing things the old way? What do you think is one, you know, a couple of the drivers that keep us in that old paradigm?
I think one of the main ones, at least currently in our current context, is bureaucratic inertia. You know, it's just, mm-hmm. we're not going to get into the origins of the FDA, but it started out to protect people, but now there's so much red tape that in many ways it's prohibitive. We're unable to launch things as quickly as we probably should be able to. And that's well documented. There's also, of course, the very, you know, we've discussed this in prior podcasts, and there's no secret that we don't like to change things up in medicine. Many people will get very caught up in their algorithms and in tradition and doing things the way they've always done them. And not only is it uncomfortable to change, but sometimes it's often expensive in terms of if there are new modalities coming out. Sometimes we have to change the way that they're administered, and training people is expensive. I think about, like, doing, and this isn't really in regard to novel therapeutics, but in different ways of administering, like at least in ovarian cancer, intraperitoneal, so chemotherapy that was infused directly into the abdomen. There were several studies showing potential benefit to that, and one pretty impressive study that came out about 10 years ago, and that's almost completely been abandoned for several reasons good and several reasons probably not so good. And one of the not so good reasons is it is very difficult to administer. It's expensive. It often requires overnight stays in the hospital. And practices had to completely change to accommodate that. And it's really hard to make people change their comfortable practice patterns. It's one thing if you're just changing one infusion for another. Sure. It's another thing if you're asking people to change their entire practice setup for a new modality.
And one thing I don't want to show my hand too much about how cynical I can be sometimes, but one thing that I think that is very insightful that you mentioned was medicine doesn't like to change. And I think that part of that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like part of that, unfortunately, is maybe like a professional inertia where you have a certain researcher who built their career on a certain treatment modality. And at the time, that treatment modality was very good. But as time goes on, we find that that treatment modality may be out of date. But that researcher built a career around their success. And and in the urgent care world, we don't have near as much of this, you know, like, you know, cutting edge ways to fight COVID or something. But right. I think in oncology and cardiology and different surgeries, these kind of high profile practices, you might have a little bit more of that.
Absolutely. Yeah, no question. And so though, you know, people who've, I don't think it's intentional or malicious in any way, but people who spent their whole career, their whole lives in researching something because they have a strong belief in its role in patient care, they're not going to give that up easily. And I also would say, nor should they, because a lot of, you know, many times the best new thing actually turns out not to be the best new thing. But when evidence accumulates, often those people that are trying to hold on to the past way of things are not ready to give it
sure,
up. And,
sure.
And that's because it's, you know, their reputation. They don't want to be part of history. And honestly, more often than not, things are changing so rapidly that they won't even make the history. It's just a blip in a journal from 10 years ago.
Sure.
And that's really hard to swallow.
Now, you mentioned some of these new therapies, and I'd like to maybe go back a little bit to some of these immunotherapies, because I have this idea, when I started my career, I was deeply interested in cancer. And I think I mentioned this on our previous interview. I was reading Emperor of All Maladies. That's what it was.
Oh, yeah. Such a good book.
Great book. But I convinced myself that I had cancer of everything, right?
Mm-hmm. You told me. Yep.
And I think that people who are in healthcare tend to do this with a lot of different things, but especially early on in your experience with healthcare. But when I was very interested in cancer, it seemed like, you know, 15 years ago, cancer was this thing that oh, it's pneumonia. Okay, no big deal. It's not cancer. It's just heart disease. No big deal. But I feel that we're at a transition point where potentially in the next 20, 30 years, cancer will be seen as pneumonia and heart disease were 40 and 50 years ago, where it's like,
yeah,
our idea of cancer as a death knell may go away. Do you foresee that in the next coming decades at all?
I would argue that it's already here. That you know, I often, and it really depends on what disease biology we're dealing with, what
sure.
histology, what organ, what type of cancer, but I often counsel my patients that this is treated often as a chronic disease. So we're still not at the cure rate that we want to be,
mm-hmm.
obviously, which would be 100%, but we're never going to get there, if you ask me. So now we treat it as a chronic disease. We have so many more steps in the treatment paradigm currently that often we can get people years after what was formerly a pretty rapidly fatal diagnosis.
Now, can you give me an example within gynecology that you've seen yourself with this transition?
Yeah, absolutely. So PARP inhibitors have really revolutionized care in ovarian cancer. And that has happened over the last 5 years, I would say. And so these are used, I don't want to get too much in the weeds,
sure.
but they're basically used to maintain the often exceptional response that we get to frontline chemotherapy and surgery in ovarian mm-hmm. cancer. And more often than not, we can get women down to less than 1 centimeter of disease or even a complete response with no residual visible disease. And our goal is to extend the duration of that response as long as possible. And so now almost universally, women after completion of their first chemotherapy and surgical treatment of their frontline cancer treatment, they're getting maintenance therapy. And this is based on really profound data that I think is actually not only revolutionized gynecologic oncology care, but it's also affected other oncologic care sites, so breast and prostate. And these are oral medications. They're targeted at the DNA repair pathway. And they, so, you know, you have the benefit of it's a pill, still toxic, but it's a pill. And we're seeing not only pretty profound extensions in progression-free survival, but we're seeing improved rates of overall survival, especially in certain populations. And those populations are ones with DNA germline mutations like BRCA mutations or mm-hmm. RAD51 DNC. And we're seeing close to a 50% rate of no recurrence at 7 years. And at that point, we're starting to use the word cure. And that's remarkable in ovarian cancer.
Now, where was this before that?
Before that, we would have like a maybe 15% cure rate.
Wow.
Yeah. We would say 80, 85% recurrence rate. And we're still seeing that in most women, the women with mutations, and that's 15 to 20% of our population. Those women are having, you know, I am starting to tell people a 1 in 2 chance of being disease-free at 7 years.
And you feel comfortable saying that you're not afraid of new data comes out. We can't use this med anymore. You've seen this enough that you feel comfortable telling your patients this and saying, yeah, this is what we've seen.
Yeah, this is based on consistent data. So there are multiple trials looking at different PARP inhibitors and phase 3 trials. So the best we've got, all the data kind of shows the same thing. And they're all in different populations. So it's a different degree of improvement in survival, but we're seeing it across the board. And especially when it's used frontline, we're seeing some kind of contradictory data down the line if it's used later. Mm-hmm. But you know, there was one, it was November 19th, 2019. There were two of these studies were published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And that is a day we will never forget in the history of gynecologic oncology, because these survival curves have never been seen before in our disease site. So, you know, since that point, we are speaking about ovarian cancer, at least in much more optimistic
terms. In a different way. Mm-hmm. Now, these PARP inhibitors, I don't know the world of oncology, but would this fall under the broad umbrella of an immunomodulator, an immunotherapy?
No, it actually wouldn't. So they're targeted, but they are targeted at the DNA repair pathway.
Okay.
So it's a whole nother
approach.
Treatment unto itself. We actually don't use immunotherapy very much in ovarian cancer because the results that we've seen in multiple studies have been pretty lackluster, unfortunately.
So PARP inhibitors in terms of ovarian cancer, do you have any immunotherapy that you use in other gynecologic cancers at all, or is it by and large?
Yes.
Okay. So for what, for example?
Yep. So for endometrial cancer, which is the most common gynecologic malignancy we see in the U.S., especially because it's a lifestyle disease. It's a disease that's primarily related to obesity. Mm-hmm. So we've seen that this is a very, we see markers that make it often very responsive to immunotherapy. And this year, actually, at our big gynecologic oncology conference in March, there were two, again, very revolutionary studies looking at using immunotherapy in the front line of treatment. So using it in conjunction with chemotherapy. We're still using chemotherapy, but using it at the same time as chemotherapy and then continuing it for a maintenance therapy. And again, we're seeing durable responses, splits in survival curves that are, you know, like these two studies were presented together at SGO at our conference, and there was a standing ovation for like 5 minutes when we saw these survival curves. So this is, once again, revolutionized survival and treatment in one of our disease sites.
So I don't know, because what got me interested in some of the immunotherapies was a book that I read back, it was written in the 90s, A Commotion on the Blood. And in this book, the front half of it, by the time I got a hold of it, the back half, which was all new cancer treatments at the time, had been dated by probably 20 years. But the front half of the book talked about the early ideas of immunotherapy. And this had been around a long time. People had noticed that sometimes people would get fevers or they would get ill, and their secondary issue, right, this infection would all of a sudden go away after they got mounted a big febrile response. But in the book, they talk about Dr. William Coley. Are you familiar with any of his work or anything like that?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, anyone familiar with medical history, he's kind of considered the father of modern immunotherapy, although he was not recognized as such during his time.
So, and you can jump in if I'm paraphrasing it wrong, but I think that a good way to explain to people listening is this is in the 1890s and turn of the century, 1900s, and he found that some of his cancer patients would all of a sudden have a spontaneous regression of their cancer if they got sick, incidentally. And so he kind of worked down this pathway, and he developed what were later called Coley's toxins, which is essentially bacteria that he would infect people with to mount, to manifest this immune response. Am I on the right path?
Mm-hmm. You're on the right path, yeah.
So what is so crazy to me is that this is 1890, 1900. Here we are, I think Keytruda and I think some of these early immunotherapies, we started dancing around them in the late, 2008, 2009. You could probably answer that a little bit better than I could, but Keytruda, I think, is one of the big watershed treatments. Mm-hmm. When do immunotherapies come onto the stage again in the modern era?
I think you're right. I can't give you an exact year, but I would say late 2000s and primarily in the context of melanoma.
Sure. Now, here's the question, and I don't know if you could answer it. So I don't know if this is, it's kind of a big question for you, but what do you think the barrier to the adoption of Coley's toxins was at that time? Because unfortunately, we spent a whole century doing cytotoxic chemotherapy and radiation therapy and surgery. And these are all okay treatments, but they're not very good. And they have a lot of collateral damage. So why did we lose the boat for so long?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think there are several components. And I'll jump to the modern day. And I think one of the reasons that things are being adopted much more quickly, and to the credit of modern practitioners, is ease of spread of information. Mm-hmm. And the, attention to evidence-based medicine. I think back in the 19th century and honestly, most of the 20th century, evidence-based medicine wasn't really appreciated. And quite honestly, these trial designs were not present at that time. So that makes sense, but it was mainly tradition. Medicine was an apprenticeship. And so you're just learning from your forebears and saying something that so radically goes against what everyone else has taught you is, very hard to, very hard for the community to accept. And it's very hard to communicate. There's one guy saying he believes in one thing, and it's very easy to dismiss him as a quack because there's so many quacks operating around there. There's so many people saying, making similar claims that, never made it into the history books. So I think that there was a lot of caution at that time, and there still is, but more so than now, in adopting new and especially such radically different treatments and beliefs about what was going on. And they didn't really even understand the immune system at all at that point, right? They didn't have antibiotics. They didn't know what was going on. So conceptually, they couldn't understand the mechanism of it. And so it truly just seemed like quackery. Sure. So he was obviously an incredibly astute practitioner that was able to recognize what was going on in front of him. And isolate that. And that's incredible. But most people are not able to do that.
So, and you talk about how we have a better understanding of the immune system now and, the dispersion of information. And I think that makes sense. Part of, changing our thought paradigm requires a change of environment where we have computers or internet, whatever it may be. And the environment that we're operating in is different. But what's so interesting about that, and I agree with you of this idea of evidence-based medicine and, hey, the studies show this, despite us being kind of uncomfortable with it, this has a lot of evidence behind it. We should move in that direction. What's so interesting about that is I still feel that medicine can tend to be lugged down by all the baggage, not so much in oncology. I don't think so. And I can't really speak to that, but going back to our first conversation, and it was during COVID, and there was evidence pointing to contrary approaches to our old ways of doing things with COVID, and people didn't want to change. And it was just infuriating because it just didn't make any sense.
Yes. Yeah. And it definitely still happens in oncology, but I think the current generation of practicing oncologists is very good at adopting adopting new practices that are evidence-based quickly, maybe almost too quickly, because I think we look at phase two trials and we're like, wow, this is amazing. Let's move towards this. But often phase two trials don't, when they're expanded into phase three trials, don't show the same level of evidence. But I do think, you know, it's very hard. Continued lifelong learning, which is what the expectation is of us, is very hard to do. We go from this intensive multi-year process of being entirely focused on education. It's very hard to reach a point where you're ready to completely change practice. Like, you have to continue that dedication to lifelong learning. Sure. And I think for a lot of people in medicine, that actually is very hard. There's so many external stimuli and so many things pulling on us all the time. And it's hard to be like, it's time to sit down or spend my PTO time going to a conference to make sure I've learned everything I need to learn over the last year. And, you know, it's very important, but I think we all always have to remind ourselves that things are changing and we have to stay up to date with it for the sake of our patients.
So, I mean, I guess another way we could also think about it is, you know, I was talking about the environment that you practice in, but part of that physical environment is comprised of your peers who are much older, who have been trained in other means. And sometimes we don't think of them as fixed, I should say a fixture within the clinic, but having an older practitioner can sometimes can bring a lot of wisdom, but it can bring some rigidity in development of new ideas.
For sure.
Now, you talked a little bit about adopting new ideas and lifelong learning. What about, because I really like the way you think. I like that you bring a different approach towards medicine. Not a problem. So part of what I like about Coley, you know, a lot of medical mavericks, you have Ignaz Semmelweis, you have Lister, you have these people who they feel comfortable going against the grain, is they bring a new idea in. The question would be is, as you get more and more medical training through years or residencies or clinic or whatever it may be, as you get more formal training, is there the risk whereby these individuals who are so trained in the Western medicine dogma, they start closing down their focus to these new and different ideas and focusing on the studies and data that has already occurred and closing down the idea of opportunities outside of the existing paradigm?
I would say no question. Like, it's especially with a extensive amount of knowledge that's available now and trying to assimilate all of that and, you know, on top of just the everyday interactions that you have and the things pulling at your attention, the EMR, the chats on your phone, all of these things, like, you're constantly unable to focus your attention, I would say, for the most part. And so it's really hard to be able to think outside of the box. You have to be able to do that in a very intentional way. And most people, and often myself included, like, it's not vilifying everyone else. Like, most of the time you're just trying to get through the day doing the best you can for all of your patients with all of the different things pulling at you. So trying to truly change, I would say at this point in time, most of the people truly changing medicine are primarily research-based. It is incredibly hard to be a clinician who's also doing frontline state-of-the-art research. Like, that just, between the amount of financial support you need, the amount of time you have to dedicate to it, it's very hard to combine those two components of medicine into one person.
So if you look at medicine, and you've studied this a lot more than I have, but if you look at medicine over the last 120, 130 years, I think early on, being part-time researcher, part-time clinician was much easier.
Absolutely, yes.
Partially because there was some low-hanging fruit, to be fair. But at the same time, the physician-scientist was a very real thing. As we've moved on, I feel like we've moved away from that. And I agree with you with this idea that we have bedside clinicians, and then we have researchers. And to do new research is really hard. And unfortunately, the clinic bureaucracy or system is not really welcoming to the idea of, hey, we're just going to let our provider just do some research on the side. Do you think that medical education has caught up with this? Or do you still think that there's some vestiges of the old way where, you know, your physicians are trained in the citric acid cycle and you're sitting there and you're like, okay, do I really need this as a bedside provider?
Yeah, I think academic medicine is, those academic environments are different than most practices, which are primarily clinical practices. And I think in those academic settings, you have a bunch of young learners, and honestly, most research studies that are published, not the practice changing ones, but most research studies come from a resident or a fellow, mm-hmm. taking on something that they're more experienced at attending has noticed. And they'll say, like, let's follow this string and see if there's anything to be found at the end of this thought process. And you can do all of the work, you know, sure. Somebody else can follow. Yeah. But they'll also kind of have the observation, that valuable observation that comes from being inquisitive and having experience in the field and knowing what's an outlier and what's not. And so I think there's a difference between primarily clinical practice, which is what I'm in, while still trying to be involved in research, and academic practices, because academic practices are founded on the fact that they're still trying to be clinical physician scientists. And you're not going to get those new drug modalities out of the majority of those physicians, because you really need a PhD at this point to do that, and you really need to have a lab, and it's very hard to come up with new therapeutics, although many oncology physicians that I'm aware of are doing a great job of moving our field forward. Mm-hmm. But I think that there is a difference between the majority of practitioners and those that are in academic medicine.
Now, you mentioned you need a PhD to do this. Are a lot of these researchers just PhD biochemists, or are they still MDs with a PhD latched on top of it?
There's often a combination. So often you'll have a PhD as well as an MD PhD, someone who's entirely devoted to bench research, and then you'll have an MD who kind of has the clinical component, and that's necessary to be able to push forward these bench research concepts. And so that's kind of the foundation of translational medicine, translating from bench to practice. Mm-hmm. And that's where the MD PhD falls into place.
Sure, sure.
Maybe they don't have as much skill as a researcher. And if they're spending that much time in the lab, they probably don't have as much skill as a clinician either, to be honest. But they play that role as a moderator between those two worlds.
Kind of a liaison between the two. So yeah. Shifting back, we've kind of covered a lot of things, and I don't want to get too sidetracked because I could talk about this stuff forever. It's just so fascinating. But we talk about a new paradigm in cancer treatment and cancer care, right? Where you're talking about where it's now management of a chronic illness. Now, I would argue that the success of antibiotics took away the fear of infection from a lot of people. After a couple generations, by and large, infections, COVID is different, but outside of COVID, people didn't seem to mind new infections. And they had this idea that so their relationship with the treatment regimen changed, where, oh yeah, just give me some antibiotics, this isn't a big deal. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that caused two problems. The first was we overused these antibiotics when we didn't necessarily need to, right? Some of these treatment modalities, mm-hmm. and thus decreasing their effectiveness. Now, I know cancer doesn't exist in the same way of bacterial resistance and whatever it may be, but the second thing that I think it possibly did was that it shifted people's focus, and most importantly, medicine's focus, away from prevention of illness to treatment of illness. Do you find that that may happen here with cancers? And, you know, in 50 years, everybody's going out getting blistering sunburns. I'm like, oh, I'll get some melanoma. No big deal. No big deal. I'll just treat it.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to get there until there's truly a reliable cure for most cancers. Mm-hmm. And like I said before, I am skeptical that we will ever get there for most cancers, maybe many generations from now. But, find a cure for cancer is not a concept that should be present in our dialogue, just because it's such a complex thing, which I can talk about that for a while. But I think infection is an acute thing. And so people view it as an acute issue. That's not always the case, but antibiotics can often clear up this acute issue. I think there's still some fear, and not as much fear as there should be around chronic issues like diabetes and heart failure. But cancer, I think, falls into that category. And I think we still have the, that C word still holds a lot of sway in our society. And I think it's going to take a really long time for that to go away. We need to be better at the treatments we have. Even though we're better at them than we were 20 years ago, we're not good enough to be, to take away that fear, I don't think.
Now, this prevention aspect, which I truly feel my background is more focused on prevention rather than treatment of disease. And I feel that I'm wholly convinced that I think prevention should be the first go-to of any medical practitioner. And I know that that's biased, and we don't necessarily have to go down that path, but, do you feel that, that we're going to run into the same issue where there's no financial incentive to prevent illness if we have these really good treatments that, I mean, quite frankly, are ridiculously expensive?
Yeah, totally. I think we're going to run into that. I mean, I think that the prevention is not fun. It's not sexy. It doesn't get compensated well. No. But I totally agree with you. I think prevention should be the prioritization of all of medicine. We in the U.S. are particularly bad at that. Even like in my world, cervical cancer, people always talk about curing cancer, but we actually have a vaccine currently that can prevent cervical cancer and many head and neck cancers. We're seeing that rise in the population because of HPV.
Yeah.
HPV. And the vaccination rate in this country is abysmal. It should be so easy. Like the fact that we're not all vaccinating our children with Gardasil is mind blowing to me, because we don't want to talk about why haven't cured cancer yet. And you're like, why won't you just not get it in the first place? Right. Mm-hmm. Like, why are we having this conversation right now? So yeah. I don't think prevention is not appreciated in this country. And I don't know that it ever will be. I think that the financial structure and the entire structure of our healthcare system is going to have to change substantially before it's appreciated.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would love to. I mean, we could go into that and that would be an hour long talk. But I do feel that the way that the system is set up right now, it is not designed to prevent illness. It's designed to treat illness, because you don't make money preventing illness. And unfortunately,
illness is rewarded. We're rewarded for treating illness once it gets to those late stages.
Yeah. And as you say, prevention is not sexy, but we'll sit there and watch all the people fall off the bridge and be like, oh my God, we get to rush in. We get to fix them when they fall off the bridge. But the construction worker who just fixes the bridge doesn't get anything, the metaphorical preventer of problems. Well, we could talk for a really, really long time, and I don't want to take too much of your time. Thank you for doing another interview.
Of course. Yeah.
I like your insight. It's very nice. It's very cool.
Thank you.
Anything else you want to really cover real quick?
I think that's it. I just want to say one more thing about like prevention. I think we're actually kind of moving away from that currently.
What do you mean?
I think this is a controversial thing to say, but
do it.
at least in my field of oncology, there are many cancers that actually are very lifestyle related and obesity related. And I already mentioned endometrial cancer, and colon cancer is another big one on that. But it is getting increasingly difficult to address some of these unhealthy aspects of modern life in an honest way without being seen as discriminating.
Yeah, prejudice. Yeah.
And so I think that that puts us in a really tough position. It's really hard to navigate some of those conversations when you're like, I mean, this is clearly mechanistically shown to be related to this. It's not a bias. It's not an implicit bias against you as a person. It's just, this is the fact of the matter as we know it at this point. And I don't think that that's, you know, we've been talking about overturning paradigms. I don't think that's a paradigm that's going to be overturned. I think that that's, there are unhealthy ways to live and there are healthier ways to live. And sure, we're not really allowed to clearly talk about those healthier ways to live in an honest way anymore. And so we're moving away from prevention, if anything, I feel.
I would agree with that. I think that medicine I think medicine is a lot more politically motivated than people are willing to admit, and within medicine, and people are willing, are aware of outside of medicine. And unfortunately, I think that a lot of these issues with lifestyle choices, these are big political and socioeconomic, and these are out, for better or worse, these are outside of medicine. In a sense, and we need to address those issues there. But once you come into the clinic door, how you got to where you're at matters, but unfortunately, medicine has been tasked with fixing the problems outside of the clinic, the racial inequalities, the socioeconomic inequalities. And unfortunately, we can't have those honest discussions about hard science, and we have to talk about all this other stuff, which is important, but I don't know if it's necessarily medicine's role.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with that. Yeah, I think that there's so many, structural components to health and the lack thereof, and I totally agree with you that we're trying to fight those trends that clearly that's impossible to do in the world that we're in right now.
Well, thank you again for coming back on the show. Again, that was Dr. Aaron Blake. Yeah.